Chapter 31. The iTunes Store. I'm the Pied Piper. Warner Music. At the beginning of 2002, Apple faced a challenge. The seamless connection between your iPod, iTunes software, and computer made it easy to manage the music you already owned. But to get new music, you had to venture out of this cozy environment and go buy a CD or download the songs online. The latter endeavor usually meant foraying into the murky domains of file sharing and piracy services. So Jobs wanted to offer iPod users a way to download songs that was simple, safe, and legal. The music industry also faced a challenge. It was being plagued by a bestiary of piracy services, Napster, Grokster, Nutella, Kazaa, that enabled people to get songs for free. Partly as a result, legal sales of CDs were down 9% in 2002. The executives at the music companies were desperately scrambling, with the elegance of second graders playing soccer, to agree on a common standard for copy-protecting digital music. Paul Vidich of Warner Music and his corporate colleague, Bill Radichel of AOL Time Warner, were working with Sony in that effort, and they hoped to get Apple to be part of their consortium. So a group of them flew to Cupertino in January 2002 to see Jobs. It was not an easy meeting. Vidich had a cold and was losing his voice, so his deputy, Kevin Gage, began the presentation. Jobs, sitting at the head of the conference table, fidgeted and looked annoyed. After four slides, he waved his hand and broke in. "You have your heads up your asses," he pointed out. Everyone turned to Vidich, who struggled to get his voice working. "You're right," he said after a long pause. "We don't know what to do. You need to help us figure it out." Jobs later recalled being slightly taken aback, and he agreed that Apple would work with the Warner-Sony effort. If the music companies had been able to agree on a standardized encoding method for protecting music files, then multiple online stores could have proliferated. That would have made it hard for Jobs to create an iTunes store that allowed Apple to control how online sales were handled. Sony, however, handed Jobs that opportunity when it decided, after the January 2002 Cupertino meeting, to pull out of the talks because it favored its own proprietary format from which it would get royalties. "You know Steve, he has his own agenda," Sony's CEO Nobuyuki Idei explained to Red Herring editor Tony Perkins. "Although he is a genius, he doesn't share everything with you. This is a difficult person to work with if you are a big company. It is a nightmare." Howard Stringer, then head of Sony North America, added about Jobs, "Trying to get together would frankly be a waste of time." Instead, Sony joined with Universal to create a subscription service called PressPlay. Meanwhile, AOL Time Warner, Bertelsmann, and EMI teamed up with Real Networks to create MusicNet. Neither would license its songs to the rival service, so each offered only about half the music available. Both were subscription services that allowed customers to stream songs but not keep them, so you lost access to them if your subscription lapsed. They had complicated restrictions and clunky interfaces. Indeed, they would earn the dubious distinction of becoming number 9 on PC World's list of the 25 worst tech products of all time. The magazine declared, "The service's stunningly brain-dead features showed that the record companies still didn't get it." At this point, Jobs could have decided simply to indulge piracy. Free music meant more valuable iPods. Yet because he really liked music and the artist who made it, he was opposed to what he saw as the theft of creative products. As he later told me, "From the earliest days at Apple, I realize that we thrived when we created intellectual property. If people copied or stole our software, we'd be out of business. If it weren't protected, there'd be no incentive for us to make new software or product designs. If protection of intellectual property begins to disappear, creative companies will disappear or never get started. But there's a simpler reason. It's wrong to steal. It hurts other people, and it hurts your own character. He knew, however, that the best way to stop piracy, in fact, the only way, was to offer an alternative that was more attractive than the brain-dead services that music companies were concocting. We believe that 80% of the people stealing stuff don't want to be. There's just no legal alternative, he told Andy Langer of Esquire. So we said, let's create a legal alternative to this. Everybody wins. Music companies win. The artists win. Apple wins. And the user wins because he gets a better service and doesn't have to be a thief. So Jobs set out to create an iTunes store and to persuade the 5 top record companies to allow digital versions of their songs to be sold there. I've never spent so much of my time trying to convince people to do the right thing for themselves, he recalled. Because the companies were worried about the pricing model and unbundling of albums, Jobs pitched that his new service would be only on the Macintosh, a mere 5% of the market. They could try the idea with little risk. We used our small market share to our advantage by arguing that if the store turned out to be destructive, it wouldn't destroy the entire universe, he recalled. Jobs' proposal was to sell digital songs for 99 cents, a simple and impulsive purchase. The record companies would get 70 cents of that. Jobs insisted that would be more appealing than the monthly subscription model preferred by the music companies. He believed that people had an emotional connection to the songs they loved. They wanted to own Sympathy for the Devil and Shelter from the Storm, not just rent them. As he told Jeff Goodell of Rolling Stone at the time, I think you could make available The Second Coming in a subscription model, and it might not be successful. Jobs also insisted that the iTunes store would sell individual songs, not just entire albums. That ended up being the biggest cause of conflict with the record companies, which made money by putting out albums that had 2 or 3 great songs and a dozen or so fillers. To get the song they wanted, consumers had to buy the whole album. Some musicians objected on artistic grounds to Jobs' plan to disaggregate albums. There's a flow to a good album, said Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails. The songs support each other. That's the way I like to make music. But the objections were moot. Piracy and online downloads had already deconstructed the album, recalled Jobs. You couldn't compete with piracy unless you sold the songs individually. At the heart of the problem was a chasm between the people who loved technology and those who loved artistry. Jobs loved both, as he had demonstrated at Pixar and Apple, and he was thus positioned to bridge the gap. He later explained, "When I went to Pixar, I became aware of a great divide. Tech companies don't understand creativity. They don't appreciate intuitive thinking, like the ability of an A&R guy at a music label to listen to 100 artists and have a feel for which 5 might be successful. And they think that creative people just sit around on couches all day and are undisciplined, because they've not seen how driven and disciplined the creative folks at places like Pixar are. On the other hand, music companies are completely clueless about technology. They think they can just go out and hire a few tech folks. But that would be like Apple trying to hire people to produce music. We'd get second-rate A&R people, just like the music companies ended up with second-rate tech people. I'm one of the few people who understands how producing technology requires intuition and creativity, and how producing something artistic takes real discipline." Jobs had a long relationship with Barry Schuller, the CEO of the AOL unit of Time Warner, and began to pick his brain about how to get the music labels into the proposed iTunes store. "Piracy is flipping everyone's circuit breakers," Schuller told him. "You should use the argument that because you have an integrated end-to-end system, from iPods to the store, you can best protect how the music is used." One day in March 2002, Schuller got a call from Jobs and decided to conference in Vidich. Jobs asked Vidich if he would come to Cupertino and bring the head of Warner Music, Roger Ames. This time, Jobs was charming. Ames was a sardonic, fun, and clever Brit, a type, such as James Vincent and Johnny Ive, that Jobs tended to like. So the good Steve was on display. At one point early in the meeting, Jobs even played the unusual role of diplomat. Ames and Eddie Q, who ran iTunes for Apple, got into an argument over why radio in England was not as vibrant as in the United States, and Jobs stepped in saying, "We know about tech, but we don't know as much about music, so let's not argue." Ames had just lost a boardroom battle to have his corporation's AOL division improve its own fledgling music download service. "When I did a digital download using AOL, I could never find the song on my shitty computer," he recalled. So when Jobs demonstrated a prototype of the iTunes store, Ames was impressed. "Yes, yes, that's exactly what we've been waiting for," he said. He agreed that Warner Music would sign up, and he offered to help enlist other music companies. Jobs flew east to show the service to other Time Warner execs. "He sat in front of a Mac like a kid with a toy," Vidich recalled. "Unlike any other CEO, he was totally engaged with the product." Ames and Jobs began to hammer out the details of the iTunes store, including the number of times a track could be put on different devices and how the copy protection system would work. They soon were in agreement and set out to corral other music labels.